reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome students with us from Badger High School. Would they stand, please? I thought it was you. You may be seated. Thank you for coming. The students are here with our Court with Class program. This is a program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. It is a national award-winning program. We invite students from around the state to come join us for an oral argument. If they agree to do that, the students are given copies of the briefs in the case they are about to hear and may undertake a variety of activities relating to this case. They will then meet at noon, or after this case, with a justice of this court. The justice will discuss with the students the procedures the court uses, not the substantive issues of the case. And anyone in the courtroom, or any of your friends outside the courtroom, may certainly come to participate in the noon proceedings with the justice. Now, today we're scheduled to have Justice Wilcox, who is seated to my right. He has a cold, so whether he shows or not depends on how he's feeling then, but if it's not he, then one of the other justices, and I think it may be Justice Bradley, will take over for him. So now you've met Justice Wilcox to my right, and then to Justice Wilcox's right is an empty chair. And ordinarily, Justice Patrick Crooks sits in that chair. He will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for today, 03-2097CR, State v. Peter A. Is it Fonte or Font?
Fonte.
And representing the state of Wisconsin in this case is Assistant Attorney General William Gansner. Mr. Gansner, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Sadly, there are several tens of thousands of intoxicated operation or drunk driving arrests in Wisconsin every year. Tragically, each year there are several hundred fatalities related to alcohol, intoxicated-related vehicle operation, and several thousand injuries. This is one of those cases. In 2001, so a Walworth County jury has found, the defendant, Mr. Fonte, operated a motor vehicle, a motorboat, on Geneva Lake in an intoxicated condition and with a prohibited blood alcohol level in excess of 0.10, leading to the death of one person whose body was not recovered for a number of months from the lake, and the injury of another person. He was convicted of both intoxicated homicide and injury by intoxicated operation of a motor vehicle. Given the thousands of drunk driving arrests in this state annually, it has long been recognized by the legislature that while it is usually the case that a chemical test to determine the level of intoxication of an arrested individual at the time of operating the vehicle, while it is commonly understood that in most cases samples to be subjected to chemical testing will be taken from an individual, be it blood, breath, urine, once upon a time saliva in Wisconsin. In most cases, those samples will be taken within a three-hour period after the operation of the vehicle. But the legislature has also long recognized, and it is a sensible recognition, that in not all cases will it be possible for a sample to be taken within 3 hours, given the myriad of circumstances under which an intoxicated operation may happen, delay in reporting or detection of the event. The legislature has long understood that it will not always be the case that a sample can, in fact, be taken from an arrested individual within 3 hours. And thus, the legislature has, for many decades, recognized in the statutes, however they may otherwise have changed, the statutes governing the admissibility of chemical test results, the legislature has long recognized that chemical test results taken within, once upon a time, 2 hours of operation, now 3 hours, and chemical test results on samples taken more than 3 hours. And just for the sake of using a shorter form of words here, because this is an area where tongues can get tangled, I'm going to refer to -3 and +3 as a shorthand way of referring to the two distinctions. The statute, as it now exists, and as it has existed in this relevant aspect for many decades, has provided that the admissibility at a trial of chemical test results on samples that are -3 and +3 are to be differently treated. But the key aspect, in our view, is that while the different treatment to be accorded the -3 and +3 chemical test results, the difference is in determining their admissibility. Once admissibility has been decided, the effect to be given to the evidence is the same.
Well, so that's the experiment here. the question I have is that here Judge Kennedy gave instruction 1185, and I think your opposing counsel argues that, look, okay, you had expert testimony. Probably you could have used 1185, but why should it be given the prima facie value? In other words, if the interpretation is yes, you can use it, but why should it have the same effect as a test taken less than 3 hours? And that seems to be a very good question that they're asking. Why would you use that instruction with that information?
And, Your Honor, we believe that the answer is because that's precisely what the statute provides.
I want to follow up Justice Wilcox's question, because you argue that that's what the statute provides, but as I understood your argument, you said that the statutes provide for admissibility. Once you get admissibility, the effect is the same. I look at this statute, and I don't see it that way, and I want you to help me out here. As I read 885.235 sub 3, it says if it's not taken within 3 hours, evidence of the amount of alcohol in the person's blood or breath as shown by chemical analysis is admissible only if expert testimony establishes its probative value. So when you have probative value. And then two, may be given prima facie effect only if the effect is established by expert testimony. Aren't those two separate things?
I don't believe they are, Justice Butler, and let me try to explain why. As we view it, what the two statutes do, 1GC for -3 test results taken on samples taken within 3 hours, and 885.235.3 on the +3 samples, is to say this. Both statutes contain two things. One, under what circumstances will -3 and +3 test results be admissible? And then two, once the test results are admissible, how may the jury treat them? minus three test results are mandated by the legislature as being admissible, assuming a competent analyst performed the test and that the machinery was working, the procedures were proper. The legislature and this court has long recognized that minus three chemical test results are mandated in their admissibility. The legislature has determined there need be no doubt, we need have no controversy at trial over that. Plus three, the legislature has long said, plus three test results are admissible only if an expert establishes their probative value. Probative value means relevance.
Right.
The chemical test results on plus three samples are relevant only if an expert can testify, extrapolating, looking at the absorption rate and the metabolizing data and rules in this area of chemistry. Only if those test results are probative, only if they are relevant. They are relevant only if the examiner, the expert, can testify from a sample taken more than 3 hours after the event what the blood alcohol level was at the time of operation.
But
once the expert says it was 0.06, it was 0.10, then the evidence is relevant because it is evidence of what the blood alcohol level was at the time of operation. And that's the only relevant inquiry, blood alcohol at the time of operation.
Here's my point.
Okay.
Assume for sake of argument that instead of being 0.12 or above, we're looking at 0.07. And that was what the expert testimony would show. That would get you your probative value to get you admissibility. That would not get you a prima facie effect.
Absolutely.
And that's the point of my question, is that when you look at the second part of the statute, expert testimony has also got to establish the prima facie aspect. So I see them as two different things.
Right.
All right.
Right. Precisely.
How does an expert establish prima facie effect?
Well, the statute defines what the prima facie effect. The statute says, subsection C, 1GC says, this was under the then applicable statute that said, if the blood alcohol level concentration at the time of operation, okay, is 0.1 or more, that is prima facie evidence. Now it's 0.08.
Okay. Now, the jury is not told this is prima facie evidence.
No.
What's the jury told under C?
What the jury is told is, in essence, not using the legal language of prima facie, but they are told what the effect of prima facie
is,
that you may find on the basis of that evidence alone that the individual at the time of operation was under the influence. But the instruction says you are not required to do so. You're not required to do so because without that not required to do so, it would be a directing of a verdict, and that's unconstitutional.
And that was the instruction given here.
That's exactly
right. Exactly. That's my point of my question. Now let me just ask you one other question.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Now we're going to go to three.
Yes.
The language that's different from 3 and C is as follows. In C, it says, is prima facie evidence. In 3 is, may be given prima facie effect,
right,
only if the effect is established by expert testimony. So what is the jury told? You may rely on this solely?
Yes.
Well, how is it different from 3? See, the language is different.
In both cases, Justice Abramson, it's our view that once admissibility has been determined, and remember, plus three evidence is admissible only if it's relevant, and it's relevant only if it establishes, it can be used only for conviction, only if the expert testifies that at the time of operation, the individual, in this case, had a blood alcohol level of 0.1 or higher.
Butler's question to you.
Not necessarily true, because you can have probative evidence at beneath 0.10.
Right, but it won't support a conviction for operating under the influence, operating with a prohibited alcohol concentration.
Not a PAC, right.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It can be considered evidence of intoxication. But it can be considered prima facie. You may base a verdict of guilt upon that evidence only if the expert testimony says, I can extrapolate from a test sample more than 3 hours afterwards what the blood alcohol level was at the time of operation, and it's 0.1 or higher. If the expert can testify to that, then the jury is entitled to give a prima facie effect to that evidence in the same way that under 1GC, the jury can give prima facie evidence to it if done within 3 hours.
Does the, assuming that the expert testifies as you state,
yes,
then it's my understanding that the judge must give a prima facie evidence instruction. Is that your position?
Well, our position is that the instruction, the customary standard instruction that is written for under 3 hours, because, of course, we don't have a standard instruction for plus three, which is one of the problems here, and I think we can talk perhaps about why we don't. But it's our view that the same instruction should be given. If the expert testifies that at the time of operation, even though I'm using a test sample that was taken more than 3 hours afterwards, if the expert testifies, my analysis of that plus three sample leads me to conclude to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the individual's blood alcohol level was 0.1 or more at the time of operation, then that evidence can be given the same prima facie effect by the jury as evidence that there was a 0.1 on a sample taken within 3 hours because the statute says so.
Just want to make sure we're not crossing each other.
Please.
Suppose we had an expert, it's over 3 hours, expert testifies it's 0.1 or higher at the time of operation. All right, now we're going to the trial court and we're looking for jury instructions.
Yes.
There's a fight between the state and the defense counsel. Mm-hmm. Defense counsel does not want a prima facie effect instruction. You do. Is that right?
Sure.
If the expert witness testifies in the way you've stated it, would it be error for the trial judge not to give the state a prima facie jury instruction?
Would it be error for the trial court not to give that instruction?
Yes. I want to know that. That's an interpretation of sub 3. You are saying 3 becomes 1GC once you got the expert witness. That's what I hear you say. And I say to you, that's interesting, because C says is, and 3 says may. So I want to know whether you really mean that it's both the same. So my test is it error?
Right. Here's the answer to the question. And
yes,
what happened in this case is that
I want to know what's the answer to my question,
okay.
Yes or no?
The answer is that the jury should be given the same instruction, which in both cases tells the jury, you may conclude from this evidence that the individual was under the influence of an intoxicant, but you are not required to do so.
Yeah, but the difference is, if you don't give a prima facie, this is what I'm really driving at, so we understand it. My understanding, and I'm looking at jury instruction 232, which is not prima facie. That instruction says you may consider the analysis that discusses the analysis. It may be considered by you in determining whether the defendant was under the influence of an intoxicant at the time of the alleged operating. However, by itself, it is not a sufficient basis for finding that a person was under the influence of an intoxicant at the time of the alleged operating by itself. The difference is the prima facie says you can do it by itself.
Your Honor, can I just ask you what you were reading from? That has to do with the
I'm making it up. It's 232,
okay.
And it's where it's less than 0.08 grams. And the only reason I'm reading it is not that it applies in this case.
Sure.
It's the difference between an instruction for prima facie and instruction not prima facie.
Absolutely. This statute, 885-235, does more than deal with simply test results of 0.10 and higher It doesn't deal simply with those. It also deals with whatever the test result was. And depending upon what the test result is, the legislature has said it will have a different effect. So, for instance, if it's more than 0.0 but less than 0.1, it is only relevant evidence but may not be given any prima facie effect. If it's between 0.1, if it's more than 0.1 then but less than 0.08, all right, it is also relevant evidence but is not to be given any prima facie effect. It's only when it's above the prohibited level that it is to be given, can be considered by the jury as having a prima facie effect.
I'm really trying to find out the difference between the two kinds of instructions. If it's prima facie, the jury can consider, can find from the fact of the tests alone that there's, that he's under the influence.
Yes.
If it's not prima facie, the instruction is you can't do it on the basis of the test alone. You have to consider all evidence and give the test and everything else.
Right. And both, the difference between is prima facie case evidence and may be given prima facie evidence. The difference is, in terms of what the instruction should be, a court would be entitled to say, under the law of Wisconsin, if a test result is conducted on a sample under 3 hours, the law says that that constitutes prima facie evidence of intoxication at the time of operation, and you may rely upon that alone.
That fact alone, right.
Yeah. But you are not required to do so. The court has to say that.
Okay. That's right.
Under 3, it's entirely appropriate for the court to say, because of the different language may be given, that if you find, in all cases, the jury has to make a finding. Even if the test result was within 3 hours, the jury can still reject the test result. They are free to do so, and they're instructed that they can. But where the expert testifies that the test result, looking backwards, is 0.10 or higher, in those circumstances, the statute says, may be given. The jury should be instructed that you may rest your verdict on that fact alone, but are not required to do so. And that is what the instruction given in this case was. If anything, by using, in a sense, the instruction that was used here, which was simply a modification of the standard instruction on samples taken within 3 hours,
that
standard instruction could have been written in a stronger fashion. It's written in a weaker fashion that, frankly, favors the defense.
What would have been with its less than 3 hours? Now, on page 14 of the red brief is the instruction. I'm sure it's elsewhere, too. I just happened to open up to it. So I want to know. Well, it's in your argument. I want to know what would have been the instruction, or was it modified?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If you could just direct
page
me.
14.
Page 14.
Yeah. And it's bold as to what the fight's about, as I understand it.
Yes.
Okay. So if you were not, you said this was modified. Because
yes.
It's over 3. How would it have read if it was under 3?
Okay. Under 3, the instruction that was given, that you're talking about the quoted instruction that appears on page 14, right?
That's the one that was given. You say it was
modified. That's the one that was given, and it contains exactly the right language that tracks subsection 3 of the statute. You may find from that fact alone that the defendant was under the influence of an intoxicant. And that language appears in the standard instruction for minus 3. In effect, what we're saying here is, it is conceivable that the minus 3 instruction, pattern instruction drafted by the jury instructions committee, could go farther than it does. But this instruction that was used here does exactly what subsection 3 says should be said. In a sense, we're not here to argue that the that there was something wrong with the 1GC instruction, because whatever that may be, and I think it could be written in a stronger fashion, the form that it exists is precisely what the subsection 3 statute says should be said.
Counsel, I think the Chief was just trying to figure out where you think it's been modified. And really the modification, it just says at the time of operation, that's a modification from 1185, right?
Right.
And also 1185 now contains the lower level of intoxication,
yes.
And this was modified to contain the higher level of intoxication because when the crime
it was applicable. To
but otherwise, it's word for word from 1185 for the highlighted section on page 14 of your brief.
With the exception of the very opening sentence.
But that goes in advance of it. I'm just looking at the bolded part.
Yes.
If you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, that comes right out of that.
Yes.
If you are satisfied, okay.
Yes.
That's the part I think everybody's fighting about, and
yes.
And the only difference is there is you don't say at the time the test was taken, you say
right.
At the time of operation,
right.
And there's a difference in the,
no.
the amounts of alcohol, but otherwise it's the same. And then,
the bolded portion is exactly what
right.
The standard instruction says, and I think an important point to recognize, the key point we're trying to make is that this instruction does exactly what the statute says should be done in plus three cases. In fact, it may be a too timid statement of what should be instructed to the jury in minus three cases. This certainly doesn't make it an erroneous instruction in this case. It was the correct instruction in this case.
Mr. Gansner, if I could, and I know the court is interested in this issue, but your yellow light is on, and there are other issues in the case.
Thank you.
With respect to the sufficiency claim, as I understand the facts, the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state that favors sufficiency is A, that Mr. Fonte was still on the boat, and B, his statement that he manipulated the controls to pull them back.
Right.
He thought into neutral.
So
as I understand his statement, he was not at the controls at the time the propellers struck the young woman. Does this fall under Milwaukee v. Pregler? Is this enough for operation or not?
I think it is sufficient, Your Honor, and I want to make certain that I don't mislead the court as to what our argument here is. Our view is that the evidence in this case demonstrated that he was the last person at the controls of the boat, and that the evidence also permitted the jury to infer that he was the last person operating the boat immediately before the collision took place. We are not saying that this is a situation where there was a substantial period of time between his being at the controls and then when the collision occurred.
Here's the gist of my question. It kind of goes to the Kobayashi, I'm probably mispronouncing the name of the case. I think of the usual suspects when I think of that word. But it kind of goes to the Kobayashi issue where this court has said that you don't have to show intoxication as being causation for the injury or death. You have to show operation while intoxicated. If he is not at the controls when the accident takes place, do you have enough even under Kobayashi where you have operation causing death when he's not sitting at the controls?
Yes, because a boat, in fact, can be operated without a person being at the controls. He was the person that was, so the evidence permits the jury to conclude.
Right, but the offense, as I understand it, is that he has to operate at the time.
Right.
That's the, as I understand the sufficiency
right.
issue, that's what it's all about.
I appreciate that argument. Our point is that the evidence in this case was sufficient to permit the jury to conclude that he was the person at the controls immediately before the collision took place. He was the person in control of the boat. He was the operator of the boat. That there was not a substantial time period between when he was at the controls and when the collision occurred. If there was, If there was significant evidence of a time, I think we'd have a very severe sufficiency, a real significant sufficiency of the evidence question. But we believe that there is no evidence that there was a significant time period between when he was at the controls and when the collision occurred. And thus, he was the person that was still in charge of the operator of a boat, a vehicle, which can, of course, continue to operate with the controller's hands off the mechanism, unlike some other vehicles, which may go out of control the moment you take your hands away from the controls. A boat is a vehicle that can continue, as this one tragically did, to operate for a period of time, substantial period of time it can be, after the individual steps away from the controls. So it's our view that there was no substantial, the evidence permitted the jury to conclude that there was no substantial period of time between his being at the controls, leaving, and the collision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gansner. Ms. Askins, Martha K. Askins, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, Mr. Fonte.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Martha Askins. I'm from the Madison Appellate Office of the State Public Defender, and I represent Pete Fonte. The relief that I'm asking for today from this Court is to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand the case for a new trial on the homicide count.
You don't want to stretch the sufficiency claim?
Well, and I'm glad you asked that question because I think that there was certainly an error in the Court of Appeals decision in saying that they didn't need to reach the sufficiency claim because the other issue was dispositive. As this Court is well aware, of course, had the Court ruled that the evidence was insufficient, that would have ended the matter for the homicide count. So, yes, I would like the Court to address the sufficiency, but on the issue that was the subject of the petition for review, if this Court limits its discussion to this issue, that I would ask that this Court conclude that the Court of Appeals got it right, that they accurately interpreted the statute involved in this case, and that they correctly concluded that the instruction given deprived Pete Fonte of a fair trial. What I am asking the Court to rule is that when a blood alcohol test is performed more than 3 hours after the driving, first of all, when it comes to admissibility, there must be scientific expert testimony to make it admissible. And I think the State and Pete Fonte agree on that, that in order for the evidence to be admissible, there must be this expert testimony. Where we depart, I think, is what effect does this evidence with this expert testimony have? And what I hear the government arguing is that the effect is the same. Our position is that the effect is not the same, and that when it comes time to instruct the jury, it is not proper to give the pattern instruction 1185, which governs cases where the tests are performed within 3 hours. Now, I wanted to...
It is the prima facie part of the instruction that you object to, right?
Well, I wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the questions were arising about the instruction, I wanted to clarify that essentially the way that I've been looking at the instruction, the shorthand, is that Judge Kennedy took 1185, the pattern instruction, and eliminated the language that says evidence has been received that within 3 hours after the defendant's alleged operating of a vehicle, a sample of the defendant's blood was taken. So we know that's been omitted from the instruction that was given to the jury. Otherwise, it's the same. So the problem, I think, arises from the within 3 hour language connected with the prima facie language.
But let me ask this. Given the statute sub 3, understanding that we're not under 1G, how should the instruction have looked?
I think, and I always, it seems that when I have cases that start at the trial court and the court of appeals, and here we are at the Supreme Court, I sometimes refine my thinking about what the statute should say or what the instruction should be. And my view is that actually when the test is done outside of 3 hours, I don't think we need that special instruction at all about the prima facie case or about the percent alcohol. And the reason I say that is, you know, we look at this case. This case we had an expert testify, as was required, what the effect of, or, you know, did an extrapolation of the blood alcohol test. All right? The statute tells us it's outside 3 hours, so we need this expert. Well, we look at the expert's testimony, and what we see is that the expert does that extrapolation for the jury. He explained in this case, you know, we took the blood at this time. We needed to find out what his BAC was at the time of operating. So the expert walked the jury through all of this. And as I thought about this case, I asked why this particular piece of evidence would get a special instruction. And it seems to me that when you have an expert like we did in this case, you don't need that whole language.
If we accept your argument, aren't we in effect eliminating the last clause of sub 3, which reads, and may be given prima facie effect only if the effect is established by expert testimony? At least the argument, as I understand it in this case, is that the effect was established by expert testimony. How can we ignore that portion of the statute?
Well, I think I have a couple things to say about that. The other instruction that I was going to say, if we had to have an instruction, I think the proper answer is to say that this is relevant evidence on the issue of the blood alcohol at the time of the operating, rather than the prima facie, the presumptive inference language.
The statute uses the word prima facie.
Well, I think it's a little unclear what the prima facie effect actually refers back to. I think that if we think about it in terms of presumptive inferences, we have a known fact, which is the blood alcohol 7 hours later, and then we have a presumed fact. And the one relates back to the other. And as I look at that presumptive inference language, it seems to me we get into the old, you know, constitutional questions about presumptive inferences like in Ulster County and Romano and the case that the Court of Appeals cited. The one has to connect back to the other. So I think that there is discretion on the part of the trial court, depending on the evidence that comes in, that may vary what the instruction is going to be in a particular case. In this particular case, where the test was done outside the 3 hours, my position is that prima facie language that was given here is not appropriate unless it seems to me that
isn't that the problem with your argument, that if you don't have an unless, if we accept your position, we're eliminating a portion of the statute?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is I'm in looking at Ulster County. Permissive inferences are only appropriate where the ultimate fact presumed is more likely than not to flow from the basic fact that was proved. There's a burden of proof within that standard. It has to be more likely than not to flow from the former. So if the trial court concludes that it's more likely than not, then perhaps you have the language that Your Honor is addressing. But you will not always have that. And it seems to me that in the within 3 hours, that presumptive effect is, or I'm sorry, I'm stumbling here, that the one necessarily, the legislature has made a determination that the one flows from the other. And that's why I take a different position from the state in this, is that we have clearly two categories of cases that the legislature has created. The legislature has made a decision that it matters whether it's within 3 hours or outside 3 hours. And it's inappropriate to say, well, we don't care. We're going to give them all the same effect. That seems to me to be the flaw in the state's argument and the flaw in the trial court's instruction to the jury.
One of the problems I have with the statute is when I read it a number of times, I'm not sure what it means. And I'm talking about the plus 3 hours. I'm not sure what the second word effect means. You would think if two words like effect, E-F-F-E-C-T, appear within a few words of each other, they would have the same meaning. But I don't think they do. At first I thought they did, and I just glossed over it. But it's used as may be given prima facie effect. And I take that to mean may be used to decide from that fact only. You know, that's kind of shorthand for establishes what you need in order to make the essential elements of the claim. You
know, without further evidence.
Without further evidence. So that's what that effect means. May be given prima facie effect can be used as a tool in that way. If the effect, that's the effect I don't understand, because that doesn't make sense, is if the, you can decide from this only, is established by expert testimony. So the second effect doesn't mean the same thing as the first effect, I don't think.
I think that's right. I have struggled with that end of that statute as well, and I can't give you a clear answer of what I think that means. When I look at the cases that have talked about prima facie effect in this regard, two of the cases that I've looked at that have helped me somewhat are Dish and Radiman. And what those cases say is that what, if I'm reading those correctly, that what prima facie effect means, it means that the test results are presumed to be accurate as of the time the tests are taken. That way, the state doesn't have to prove each time, for example, that the measuring instrument was valid and was accurate. What these cases say is that under the statutes, the blood test derived from a properly authenticated sample is admissible by legislative fiat. So the legislature has said, we presume those to be accurate, they're admissible.
If I could follow up on Justice Bradley's question, you do not see the prima facie effect and the effect in sub 3 as referring back to 885.235.1GC?
The second use of the word effect? Is that?
Yeah. Only if the effect, in other words, only if the prima facie effect is established by expert testimony. For example, and that goes back to the question that I asked of Mr. Gansner earlier. You can have evidence of intoxication. If you look at sub 1GB, evidence between 0.04 and 0.08 is relevant evidence
right.
towards intoxication. So you can have evidence where the expert testifies in the .06 category, and it being relevant, but you don't get the prima facie effect. You only get the prima facie effect if it's over .08. So admissibility really constitutes that range between .04 and above, but prima facie only constitutes evidence over .08. Now, maybe I'm misreading the statutes, but that's how I see them if I read them together.
All I can say is the way that I read this now is that sub 3 means that in order for the blood test to be admissible, if it's outside of the 3 hours, you need expert testimony. If it's before 3 hours, we're not going to require the expert testimony. And that's how I read the statute. I have to say, you know, I think it doesn't all match up perfectly.
But that's not the issue in the case, admissibility. I think everybody agrees it was admissible.
Right.
The issue is, what kind of jury instruction do you give? If it's prima facie evidence, and that seems to be used the same way as prima facie effect, but if you look at 1GA and 1GC, two of those talk about prima facie effect. C says prima facie evidence, and I don't know if prima facie effect and prima facie evidence are different. Then you get to 3, and it says prima facie effect, only if the effect is established by expert witness, and you got the may in 3.
Right. So you have a little, yes, you do have a different text.
Yeah, and part of it, at least what I think I heard you say was, the expert testifies. The expert is clear, very firm, that at the time of operation it was over 0.1. No question in his mind. Everything is just terrific. And that then the judge has to make a decision as to which jury instruction to give. The prima facie one, which is you may consider it solely or by itself, although you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Or the one I read to you, which is, you can't consider that only, but you look at everything and that's one factor, right?
Right.
So the judge then makes that, and then we could have a fight about whether that's on what basis the judge makes it, and whether it's a discretionary call or a question of law. Yeah. That's one thing I heard. The other thing I heard was, that doesn't make too much sense either. And then it's hard to make any sense out of this. And the only kicker thing you ought to think about is, this is an admission statute. Give them, and once you admit it, the jury gets instruction that it's relevant and they can consider it. I mean, this I heard sort of two arguments, and that you were perplexed. And obviously it is perplexing.
Well, yeah, I guess this is, when I step back from it and look at it as the case as opposed to the statute, it seems to me that there are three reasons why the Court of Appeals was right. One is the legislature has drafted the statute. The legislature has these two categories, within 3 hours, outside of 3 hours, and what that says to me is we treat those differently. All right? Secondly, the state's position, it seems to me, does not make sense, and the state's position meaning give it the same effect. And the reason that that does not make sense to me is that what that means is in every criminal trial where there's blood alcohol evidence, it will not matter when the test was taken. And it seems to me that the legislature has said it does matter when the test is taken. Further, that this court has said we do care when the test was taken, that the further out you get, the less probative value it has. And finally, when we look at case law on permissive inferences, we know that permissive inferences are not appropriate unless there's a rational connection between the presumed fact and the basic fact. Okay. And those things, to me, inform the outcome of this case.
I
That's the other thing I was going to ask you about, and I note that neither of the briefs, I think I'm right, but maybe I'm not, neither of the briefs, I should say none of them, because including the reply, but I better check that, cite 90303, which deal with presumptions and talk about, if I remember, prima facie evidence. And they tell you what to do, and in fact, 90303 talks about how you instruct the jury. And it says the jury may regard the basic fact as sufficient evidence. That's the only clause as I see it. But does not require it to do so. And that's the prima facie evidence. And that's where I think the jury instruction gets that from. But I must say I haven't gone through every single case and I have not
I did look it out. I think you're correct, Your Honor, that I don't believe we cite or discuss 90303 in our briefs. I did look at 90303 in preparation for today, and what I think that my reading of the statute is that it codifies that mandatory presumptions will not be permitted, that those, you know, are unconstitutional, but that there may be, that presumptive inferences may be tolerated.
Right.
And then gives the annotations from there.
I'm not quite sure I understand. If you had been sitting as the trial judge here, and all the evidence had come in exactly the same way, and it came time for you to instruct the jury, what would your instruction have been?
The defense asked that the judge refer to it as relevant evidence. I would take one of two approaches. I would either, as I was responding to Justice Butler, I would either eliminate this whole discussion of the BAC. And the reason that I said that is that the jury has already had explained to them through this expert what the BAC is all about. And it seemed to me that they didn't need any more assistance. I mean, the point of jury instructions, of course, is to help the fact finder come to the decision and to help them understand what the evidence is. And it seems to me that that gets to what the risk was in this case, which was, did this jury instruction help them understand the evidence? And I think it did not. I think the expert explained what BAC was and how he extrapolates it. And really, they didn't need any instruction on that at all. But I think the focus was, you know, we have this pattern instruction for 1185. What should it say? I think once the evidence was, or once it was revealed that this test was not performed within 3 hours, that this needed to be rewritten if they were going to have any instruction along those lines at all. And that rather than saying, you may find from that fact alone that the defendant was under the influence, would be something along the lines of, you may find this evidence to be relevant, but not, you may find from that fact alone. And that's where I think the problem is.
And that's the difference between 232 and the prima facie. Because 232 says, which is not a prima facie instruction, says, the law gives you the analysis, and at the time of the test, the analysis of point one may be considered by you in determining whether the defendant was under the influence. However, by itself, that's the numbers.
Right.
It is not a sufficient basis for finding that a person was under the influence of an intoxicant at the time of operating. Therefore, you may consider this evidence, referring back to the BAC, I think it is, regarding a blood alcohol test, yes, along with all the other credible evidence, giving it the weight you believe it's entitled to receive.
Although, that's exactly what 232 says. I would note,
yeah, go ahead.
I would note that the outset of that instruction also, at least the one that I have, has evidence has been received that within 3 hours after the defendant's alleged driving and so forth. And that's the rub here. We don't have that test.
No, but this is the one I'm reading from 232, which is a 2004. It deals with 0.04 less, but less than 0.08. And under the statute, that is not prima facie evidence. So they give this instruction. That's what I'm trying to do. Trying to figure out where is the difference. So now I finally figured out, I hope, that's not the prima facie instruction, the one I just read to you. Doesn't say only, like 90303 says it's supposed to say only if it's prima facie. That's the whole point of sub 3. They tell you it's a rule, not a statute, but it's there. So if you think you have to give a prima facie evidence under the other sub 3, our sub 3, then the instruction given is a prima facie instruction. I went through that with Mr. Ganster. If you think you don't have to give prima facie because you don't know what the last part means, then that instruction is wrong because it's a prima facie instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a different kind of instruction when it's not prima facie, as I understand it. And I get all of this information, which may or may not be right, under the Wisconsin Jury Instructions Criminal, the introductory 2600, sub 7,
right,
which explains this, and it explains that at least the jury instruction committee thought that, although Mr. Gansner doesn't agree, that that is the correct prima facie instruction. Mr. Gansner thinks you can give a tougher instruction, if I understood his argument. But at this moment, he's not pushing for that. He just wants this to be good enough. So I don't know that where that all leads us, but that's the difference between the two, as I see it.
How about, does that have a response? No?
Just as she doesn't understand it either, I think.
How about,
that's not the integration of your argument, but that's the problem with the statute.
How about sufficiency of evidence?
Well, in order to prove, in order to convict Pete Fonte, the state had to prove two things, the intoxication and the operating. The operating, I think, is where the problem is for sufficiency of the evidence here in a couple of ways. Number one is whether there was evidence that he actually manipulated the controls in such a way as to cause the boat to drive into the swimmers. And I think that there is not evidence to
But I just heard you say cause. And
right.
Didn't that
Well, it's
case, whatever.
I say Kabiasi.
Okay, didn't that
Kabiasi says that if you're intoxicated and if you're operating the car, you're liable, and that's that.
You don't have causation.
Correct. Taken to its extreme, then, what Kabiasi says, and obviously there's another issue lurking in this case, which is the challenge to Kabiasi and the constitutionality of the statute. Taken to its extreme, if Pete Fonte is sitting at the steering wheel of the boat and it's stock still and somebody rams into his boat, he is left in the position of defending under the affirmative defense, but he's liable if he can't meet that burden, because he's operating and he's intoxicated. But I still think that Kabiasi suggests there's got to be some affirmative act on the part of the driver. Kabiasi was either a motorcycle or a car. So you're at the controls and you're going forward. This is a little bit different because it's a boat. But I think that criminal law requires a causation, even in spite of Kibiasi. I think that in order for the state to prevail, they have to be able to say that he somehow caused it and that the causation in this case was that he thought it was in neutral. That's how I understand the state's argument to be. He thought it was in neutral when it wasn't. So he made a mistake. He was at the controls. He stepped away, and the boat continued to go forward.
Let me ask you, if I could, excuse me, Justice Wilkins. Let me ask you, if I could, about the sufficiency area. And Milwaukee v. Pregler, I don't know if it was really cited. And I want to know whether you think the Court of Appeals got it right when they said, citing from a Montana case, the court found that actual physical control was not limited to putting the car in motion. We feel that their reasoning is applicable to a similar interpretation of the term operate and hold that restraining the movement of a running vehicle constitutes physical manipulation of a vehicle's controls, which falls within the scope of our statute. Now, that seems to be the facts of this case, if you accept the defense argument that he was pulling back, not trying to put it in motion, but trying to restrain it from going in motion. And then they cite to the Montana case, pointing about how accidents can happen. Preventing a car from moving is as much control and dominion as actually putting the car in motion on a highway. Could one exercise any more regulation over a thing while bodily present than prevention of movement or curbing movement? And so I guess what I'm getting at is this is a published opinion, Milwaukee v. Pregler. Did they get it right?
I don't know. I want to clarify one fact, too. The defense did not, Pete Fonte did not testify, and their defense was that the state did not prove who was driving, if anyone was. So the defense wasn't that he pulled back on the throttle. It was simply an insufficiency of proof by the government. I guess I just don't know the answer to that question.
That's fair enough.
Okay. I didn't want to just say, oh, my time is up and sit down, but
I'm not going to let you do
okay.
that.
Okay. All right.
Who was – oh, I'm sorry.
I'm still on the general 2600, which I gather you're
okay,
familiar
yes.
with. And so it's another sort of follow-up to Justice Butler, because now I'm on the subsection 10.
This is the comment,
right.
the commentary,
yeah.
introductory comments?
Right, exactly. Okay. 10 is the affirmative defense. And it says as follows. This is their interpretation. Doesn't mean it's right, but I want to know if it's your interpretation, okay? Then they talk about the instructions. They interpret the statute to mean that simple operation must be causal. That is, if you're operating, that must cause the damage. So it's not that you're operating under the influence that causes damage. You can be cold stone sober, at least for the moment. Nor does it have to be negligent. You
right.
could be absolutely doing it perfectly.
Exactly.
But under this statute, as they interpreted, what the state must prove is that there was operation and that the operation was causal. Now, do you agree with that interpretation? And then they say, well, it's very hard to explain this concept to the jury. But if you, trial judge, are going to try and explain it to the jury, maybe you better let it go, then this would be the instruction. It is not required that the harm was caused by any drinking or by any negligent or improper operation of the vehicle. What is required is that the harm caused by, was caused by the defendant's operation of the vehicle. Do you agree with that? I mean, maybe that's the same question as Justice Butler asked. I'm putting it in terms of this.
I think that what Kibiasi says is that if you are driving and...
Operating, right?
Yes. If you're operating and there is an accident or a crash, you are liable even if your driving was exemplary.
Right.
Okay. So, and where I see the flaw is that in the criminal law, there is supposed to be a cause, a connection, it seems to me. It seems to me the state should have to prove that because you were intoxicated, the collision occurred. So there has to be a nexus between the intoxication and the harm that was caused. That's the way I read Kibiasi and your dissent in Kibiasi.
No, but that's a loser.
Yeah, right. Well, it was then.
You lost it, so.
Is there a difference between losing and having a loser?
Not yet.
But that's how I read. So I didn't look at the instruction that you talked about, but I think under Kibiasi, it's a strict liability. It does not matter how you drive.
You have to be operating.
But you have to be operating.
Okay.
Yes. Whatever that means, you have to be operating. And whether the vehicle is moving or you have the ignition on but you're not moving, that's where we get into whether you're truly operating a motor vehicle. Are you sitting outside on the curb waiting to pick somebody up? Are you operating?
And it may come up where you're just sitting on the curb. Ordinarily, it's a drunk driving charge, you're sitting on the curb behind the wheel. That's operating.
That's operating.
And if somebody else hit you while you're sitting behind the wheel, hit your car and moved your car into the next car and caused somebody's death, I think that the instruction I just gave you might release the person from liability because the operation is not causal. I mean, it might.
On the other hand, you would have the burden of showing that had I not been intoxicated,
okay, right,
you know, something else would have happened. I would have averted the accident somehow.
Okay. Sorry to have kept you.
No.
Justice Prosser, I have a question. I'm sorry. Thank you, Ms. Askins. Mr. Gansner.
The Court's been so generous with the time here, I feel as though I should try to be short. I'm not often successful at doing that, but I'll try. I think the real difference between Ms. Askins' argument and mine and our disagreement with what the Court of Appeals did and the difference between what the Court of Appeals did and Judge Kennedy did is this. I think the real root of the Court of Appeals' decision and of Ms. Askins' argument is that plus three evidence is less reliable than minus three evidence. As a matter of fact, defense counsel has a good deal of leeway in arguing to the jury that the jury should view plus three evidence as having less weight than minus three evidence. But as a matter of law, the proposition that plus three evidence is less reliable than minus three evidence is wrong.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, Mr. Gansner, because the legislature has made a determination that there's a difference. That's why they require the expert testimony.
So
they see it as different. I mean, they're saying, you've got to give us more. We're not going to give you the presumption here. You've got to give us more because we see a difference.
Sure. But I believe, Justice Butler, that the difference is a matter of evidentiary admissibility. They said, we won't let this evidence come in, if it's plus three, unless you have an expert certified. There was a time when minus three evidence, it was argued, should only come in with an expert. And the legislature said, no, that's a waste of time. We are mandating the admissibility of first minus two and now minus three evidence because it is a waste of time, as Justice Heffernan, I believe, said in either Dish or Wallstad, for us to engage in an elaborate factual presentation at trial over evidence that the legislature has said we've deemed it admissible, period. But the legislature has also said if it's plus three evidence, it's not automatically admissible. It does need expert testimony for admissibility. Once admissible, however, plus three evidence may be given, and that's precisely what the legislature said in three, may be given the same prima facie evidence as minus three. And that is the distinction, I think, here between what the law is and what the jury is to do. And I think we're in some danger with Ms. Askin's argument of blurring that distinction in an unhelpful way.
I want to make sure that we understand the distinction because it may be given that effect only if the expert testimony establishes it.
Only if
you left out that last part, and I think it's an important part.
Well, and I think and what we believe that means, and I know the court went through the questions about what does the prima facie effect refer to, and I would just simply point out, I think, Justice Abramson, you were correct in referring to 1G, A, 1, and 2. When in subsection 3, dealing with plus 3 evidence, it says the plus 3 evidence is admissible only if expert testimony establishes its probative value, and it may be given prima facie effect only if effect is established by expert testimony. Maybe given prima facie effect, what does that phrase, prima facie effect, relate back to? It relates back to exactly what the legislature had said two subsections earlier.
Here's my problem. How does an expert witness testify that this evidence should be given prima facie effect? That means that there's a presumption or a rebuttable inference. So how, what does the expert witness say? On the basis of my studies, on the basis of all my degrees, blah, blah, this should be given prima facie effect. I mean, I don't understand how you do that.
No.
Then what does it mean, only if the effect according to the witness?
No expert will ever be asked at one of these cases, should this evidence be given prima facie effect?
I understand that, but then what does it say, only if the effect is established by expert testimony?
But the effect follows from the testimony that the expert does give. What was the blood alcohol level at the time of operation? If the expert testifies to this scientific fact, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, that at the time of operation, the blood alcohol level of this operator was 0.1, then, as a matter of law, it's given prima facie effect. But that's a legal question.
If he doesn't testify to that, it's not going to be probative. They won't let it in at all.
Well, no, it's probative if it's less than 0.1, because even if it's even if it's 0.01, if the statute says it's relevant evidence on whether the person was intoxicated, but it cannot be given prima facie effect.
So your position is anytime he testifies that it's 0.1 or over, by law it's given prima facie effect.
If an expert testifies on a sample taken more than 3 hours after an event, that he or she can say, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, that back at the time of operation, there was a measurable blood alcohol level, that is relevant evidence. That is correct.
I know, but that's not the question I asked you. I asked you whether when does it give a prima facie effect? And your answer, I think, is any time the expert testifies that it's over 0.1.
Yes, and that's what the statute says.
That's what
subsection 3 says. You get the prima facie effect, that terminology that's used in the statute, refers to the effect that is given to testimony establishing, if the jury finds it, if the jury agrees that it was so proven, above a certain level. Now, 0.08, then 0.01. In other words, our view is, and I've expressed this in our argument in chief here, this statute cannot be viewed as misleading because it accurately stated the law. As a result, we believe the Court of Appeals was wrong in saying that this instruction confused things, was circuitous, was misleading. It wasn't misleading. It accurately stated what the law is.
What if the jury guy testifies as .1 and the jury thinks it's .05?
Then the jury is free. This really goes to the point about the difference between what the judge instructs and what the jury can do. The jury was told in this case, you're free to reject this. They were given an instruction on expert testimony that said you can attach such weight as you wish to the expert's testimony as you wish. It was the customary instruction on experts. You are the judges of the fact. You are to determine that. That's not in the excerpt that's on page 14 because it was a separate standard instruction on experts. But they were free to reject this expert's testimony, and the defendant's attorney was free to argue, jury, you should not believe this testimony. In fact, there was an alcohol curve defense that was used. We haven't even spoken about this, but in essence, the defendant's defense was, I was drunk later, but not at the time. I only started drinking a few minutes before the collision. So I was on my way to getting drunk, but I wasn't drunk at the time. Well, the state put in evidence that hours before, Mr. Fonte was so drunk, he was asked to leave a restaurant in downtown Lake Geneva, or Fontana, I forget which. In any event, those were fact matters for the jury to determine. But in our view, the jury was absolutely appropriately instructed because the instruction given fit precisely what the evidence was and what the legislature says the instruction should be.
Thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Askins, for your argument today in 03-2097-CR, State versus Fonte. We will be in recess until 1:30. The students should remain here, and we'll see which surprise justice will appear. All right. Justice Wilcox will make the attempt, and Justice Bradley will be in the wings. Should he fall. And like an understudy. All right. Thank you. 1:30.